Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It's been hot, it's been dry, and it's been windy, and we're hoping that Mother Nature will help us out with this.
Fires spread in southwest Alaska as hot, dry weather continues. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, as some legislators celebrate the Alaska Reads Act, others worry about rural school districts.
This bill does not help rural Alaska. If you were to write a bill for big schools, I would write it just like this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
President Biden's nominee to head the Office of the Environmental Protection Agency responsible for Superfund sites says he's committed to making progress on cleaning up contaminated lands conveyed to Alaska Native corporations. Carlton Waterhouse says the problem is huge but solvable.
Obviously, there are agencies and departments that have been doing cleanups over 50 years, but we haven't got enough done over too long a time period. And so now we need to strategize on how we can really meaningfully ramp up what we're able to accomplish. And we think the key to that is working together.
Some 44 million acres have been conveyed to Native corporations as part of the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. That includes more than 900 sites that were previously contaminated with military and civilian dump sites, heavy metals, PCBs, and buildings containing asbestos. Several hundred sites have been cleaned up, but there are a lot more to go. Waterhouse says the Biden administration will take a multi-agency approach. Coordination is particularly important in Alaska, he says, because the cost of mobilizing to a remote contaminated site is so expensive.
If you think about the federal government, each sending different people to different sites at different times to deal with the same problems, rather than us kind of collaborating on how we marshal our resources and assets to be able to address the problem, it really adds to the expense. It really adds to the amount of time.
Waterhouse is still waiting for a U.S. Senate vote on his confirmation. Casey Sixkiller joined him for meetings with Native organization leaders in Anchorage. Sixkiller is the new head of EPA's Region 10, which includes Alaska. A large tundra fire is threatening the village of St. Mary's. A lightning strike about a week ago started the fire, which was within 12 miles of the community at last report. Federal entities sent in more firefighters on Tuesday, and some residents are thinking about preparing their go bags. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has the story.
Elder George Bean Sr. lives on a hill in Midtown St. Mary's. He's been smelling smoke ever since the fire began on May 31st, over a week ago.
It was a little uncomfortable and hard to breathe.
On Tuesday, the wind switched and gave the village a short reprieve from the smoke. But Beans can still see it, and it's getting worse.
There's a lot of smoke. It's thick over up north of us. It's real thick, and it seems to be getting closer, too.
The fire is getting closer and larger, too. What the Bureau of Land Management first reported as an 1,800-acre fire around 25 miles from the village last Friday had grown on Tuesday. The fire is now estimated to be 33,000 acres and is just 12 miles from the village.
It's been hot, it's been dry, and it's been windy.
That's Beth Ibsen. She's a spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management. She says the conditions and the proximity of the fire to the village prompted officials to send in more smoke jumpers and the BLM's Chena Hotshot firefighters. 8 smoke jumpers had been there since last Friday. Now there are over 40 firefighters in St. Mary's. The firefighters are setting up camps in town and will hike up to the site of the fire each day. The weather forecast looks hot and dry for the next few days, but Ibsen says she hopes that changes.
We're trying to stall this fire the weather is not cooperating. We're hoping that some of the forecasted cooler temperatures pan out this weekend, and we're hoping that Mother Nature will help us out with this.
Ibsen says she's, quote, not worried yet, but Elder George Bean Sr. says he is. Beans has been living in St. Mary's for most of his life and says this is the biggest and most dangerous fire he's ever seen. He said Tuesday was the first day he considered stocking an emergency bag with his essentials that he can quickly take with him if he needs to leave the village in a rush.
I instructed my family we need to get something ready here just so we can grab and go.
He says he lives just a short distance from the boat harbor and plans to take his family to another village on the Yukon by boat if the fire reaches St. Mary's. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Meanwhile, two lightning-caused fires have been burning around Aleknagik since Monday. The Arcana Creek fire is only 5 miles north of Aleknagik and had burned 13 acres as of this morning. Four smoke jumpers were on the scene. According to Division of Forestry spokesperson Jacob Welsh, the fire is a shallow burn.
There's potential for fire spread, and it didn't see any rain. There's a small marine layer that burned off early in the morning. So most of the day has been hot and dry out there, but it's not burrowing deep into the tundra or the duff layer.
Welsh says the Arcana Creek fire is in a suppression area, meaning there are known structures and assets nearby. The crew has called for more supplies and hopes to have it under control soon. The Kakwak River fire is much larger at over 1,000 acres burned. It's 33 miles away from the village in Wood Tikchik State Park in a low suppression area. The Division of Forestry currently has no plans to send crews to control that fire, but are monitoring the area by aircraft. Welsh says the Division of Forestry is relying on nearby creeks and rivers to keep the flames from spreading.
At this point, there's a limited to no values at risk, and a low spread is likely.
Air quality has been impacted around Bristol Bay from the two fires, as well as the 7,000-acre fire in Katmai National Park and the Dillingham Landfill Fire. The Dillingham Fire Department recommends the public close windows, wear an N95 mask outside, and to stay indoors when possible. A group of former Anchorage Museum employees is calling for an investigation into the leadership and work culture under its director, Julie Decker. Five former employees, plus the museum's former chief of security who worked as a contractor, sent a letter to the museum's board of directors last week. In it, they charged Decker with fostering an opaque, chaotic, and stressful work culture. It reads, quote, senior staff in particular were directly berated, manipulated, lied to, undermined, and met with prolonged silent treatment by the director's CEO, end quote. Kirsten Anderson is one of the authors of the letter. She was deputy director and chief curator of the museum until she resigned in 2020.
There's just a real pattern of toxicity that has been going on for years. And the reasons for the letter right now is because there's been enough stories and information and patterns that people have recognized that they're concerned, and as we all are, about future harm and reducing future harm for staff at the museum.
In an emailed statement, Decker said that she values all museum staff and says she sees employee feedback as a way to improve the museum. She wrote, quote, our focus for the past few years has been on navigating the museum and staff through this pandemic in the most human way possible, and I'm proud of how we have all pulled together to do that, end quote. Carla Beam, the chair of the museum's board of directors, said the board is taking the concerns in the letter seriously.
We'll be looking into it as we would any such concerns that are raised by the public that are appropriate for the board to handle.
Beam said in her nearly 3 years on the board, she hasn't heard any similar complaints about Decker. Decker has been the museum's director since 2013. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cruise passengers take to social media to share information on COVID outbreaks.
If I weren't in that Facebook group, I would have had no idea there was that much COVID on board.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th by mail, and an application is not needed. Ballots will start to be sent April 27th. voters receive the same ballot regardless of political affiliation and all candidates are on the ballot. The top four vote-getters move on to the special general election. Ballots must be mailed, signed, and postmarked by June 11th. More at elections.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Two Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta tribes are turning to the Alaska Superior Court in their latest attempt to block the proposed Donlin gold mine from moving forward. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The Bethel Tribe, ONC, and the Native Village of Eek are appealing the decision from the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner to issue Donlin Gold a dozen water rights permits. These permits would allow Donlin to pump up ground, river, and creek water for mining operations. The tribes are represented by the environmental law firm Earth Justice and have exhausted their appeals through the Department of Natural Resources. They have decided to take it to court. The tribe's appeal rests on two points. It says that the Department of Natural Resources has violated the Alaska Constitution by failing to consider the cumulative impacts of the mining project, and the appeal calls the permitting decision arbitrary because it, quote, failed to consider the creation of and appropriation of water for the Pitt Lake treatment works. In a statement, ONC Acting Director Calvin Cockcroft said that the tribe, quote, will continue to argue this until someone is willing to listen. A statement from Donlin Gold General Manager Dan Graham says that his company believes the state's decision to issue the permits, quote, was based on careful review and strong science. ONC could also appeal another decision regarding Donlin Gold from a different state agency. The Department of Environmental Conservation reaffirmed its decision to grant Donlin a water quality certificate. That certificate is required for Donlin Gold to conduct its mining operations under the Federal Clean Water Act. ONC has also exhausted its appeal process through the Department of Environmental Conservation on that water quality certificate. But neither ONC nor Earth Justice has said whether it plans to appeal the Donlin water quality decision to the Alaska Superior Court as well. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The return of large cruise ships to Alaska has not been going smoothly, at least for some passengers. There have been last-minute port cancellations, less to do on board, and a lot of long lines just to have a meal or to get to shore. Passengers are also surprised by how widely COVID-19 seems to spread. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has some of their stories.
Mohammed Palwala went on his first cruise last year. The cybersecurity engineer from Dallas sailed through Southeast Alaska aboard Royal Caribbean's Ovation of the Seas.
And I told my family it's like the best thing ever. You get a full-on vacation on the cruise.
Lots of entertainment on board and amazing experiences in Southeast Alaska communities. And as far as COVID, it felt safe. Everyone had to test negative before boarding. Just about everyone was vaccinated, and the ship was only at 30% capacity. That was in September. Palwala wanted to recreate the experience with his extended family of 12. He booked another Alaska cruise for May on the same ship with almost the same itinerary. This time, the ship was closer to full, with about 4,000 passengers. It wasn't like before.
Very understaffed. We did not have shows on. We only had like two shows on the whole of the cruise. Lack of entertainment, lack of entertainment for kids.
Long lines to disembark. Facilities on board were shuttered. Even eating became disappointing. His whole family is vegetarian, and he was told the kitchen was too understaffed to cook up proper meals for them. Day after day.
The same thing. I mean, yeah, not now in a few things. The same thing. So whatever we ate in lunch, we ate in dinner.
Lots of lentil soup with rice. Immediately after the cruise, 10 out of 12 people in his party tested positive for COVID. They were far from alone. There was a Facebook group with hundreds of passengers on that same sailing. At first, it was a fun space where people posted what to do in port and shared photos. After the cruise, it turned into an informal COVID tracking site with tips for dealing with Royal Caribbean customer service. Lorna Bradley from Monterey, California, was on that same cruise and in that same Facebook group.
Somebody finally just posted a poll because so many people were reporting COVID. So of the 400 passengers who happened to see the poll, 25% of those 100 people came in and said, I've got COVID.
25%.
I would have had no idea if I weren't in that Facebook group, since I didn't get sick, I would have had no idea there was that much COVID on board.
She later learned through the group that she'd been in close contact with a cabin steward who had gotten COVID. She was never formally notified of it. Even general information about the ship's COVID status was noticeably absent.
And it would have been so easy for the captain's morning announcements to just remind us, you know, oh, we have 20 passengers on board, you know, currently having COVID symptoms. And, you know, just a reminder, you know, you might want to wear a mask. I mean, that none of that happened at all, which I found surprising.
Bradley is extra COVID conscious because she has a medical condition that puts her at higher risk of complications. She also takes care of an elderly parent who's at even higher risk.
When there are COVID cases on board, on your floor, down your hall, with your cabin steward, passengers need to know so that they can make better choices for themselves.
Powell Walla says he wouldn't have taken his family if he'd known more in advance.
Definitely not because of my wife, mostly because she is pregnant. If I have known, I would have not gone.
Conditions vary from ship to ship and sailing to sailing. For example, the Carnival Spirit made headlines for a badly managed outbreak when it was coming to Seattle to begin its season in Alaska this year. Bruce Hogarth had booked the Spirit's second Alaska sailing this season. He almost canceled when he heard about the outbreak. He had travel insurance, but it wouldn't cover a cancellation for fear of COVID. He rolled the dice.
And for the first 4 days, it was a wonderful time. We enjoyed it. The service was good. The food was good. It was up to par in my mind. And then I came down with COVID. And 3 days later, my wife came down with COVID.
He thinks they could have done more to avoid people getting sick. His isolation went better than passengers on the earlier Spirit sailing.
With us, no, it was the opposite. I had lost my appetite and I wasn't eating a lot. And they would check in and say, did you want to order anything? You haven't ordered for a while. So they were very gracious that way.
Hogarth lives near Victoria, British Columbia, one of the stops on the cruise. He was able to arrange to disembark there and finish his isolation period at home instead of at a hotel in Seattle. He says a Canadian official who walked him through his isolation obligations told him 127 customers and 42 crew from the cruise were infected. Passengers are relying on secondhand information like this or Facebook polls because the cruise lines and public health authorities aren't sharing the information they already have about COVID on cruise ships. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention did not respond to questions about its COVID-19 program for cruise ships and data reporting. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska's unique approach to mental health funding is improving the lives of Alaskans who experience behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has a responsibility to generate revenue from its 1 million acres of land and the resources they contain. The trust uses this revenue to help fund statewide programs and initiatives that positively impact trust beneficiaries. To learn more, visit alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Governor Mike Dunleavy and state legislators celebrated the passage of the Alaska Reads Act yesterday in Anchorage. The act aims to improve student reading outcomes across the state by third grade. But as Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas reports, some rural legislators are skeptical about the bill's requirements for school districts.
The Alaska Reads Act provides funding for pre-K programs, uses reading screeners to identify students falling behind, and gives grants to low-performing districts. It also requires districts to develop individual reading improvement plans for students who need additional help. Governor Dunleavy and Senator Tom Begich, an Anchorage Democrat, first proposed the Alaska Reads Act 2 years ago. At a press conference at Turnagain Elementary School on Tuesday, Dunleavy said it was a bipartisan effort.
When you're dealing in a world of politics like we do, oftentimes politics gets in the middle of things. But every once in a while, there's a moral imperative that people get around.
The bill narrowly passed the House in the final hours of the legislative session. At the press conference, Senate Majority Leader Peter Michicki said The types of reading intervention funded in the bill helped his own daughter.
I know I have one daughter that struggled with reading, and the Kenai Peninsula Rural School District also already had intervention in place. She's a straight A student in eighth grade right now, doing very well. And it was because of that intervention that is designed into this bill that brought her to a place where she can excel.
Some rural legislators were skeptical about the bill. At a House floor session in May, Dillingham Independent Representative Bryce Edgman called the $30 increase to the base student allocation a joke. He said hiring reading intervention specialists would be a challenge for rural districts, where recruiting and retaining teachers is already difficult.
This bill does not help rural Alaska. If you were to write a bill for big schools, I would write it just like this.
Third graders who receive low scores on the reading tests could be held back a grade, according to the bill. Bethel Democratic Representative Tiffany Zolkowski said teachers and parents should make that decision, not the state.
My concerns are rooted in the protection of small schools, Alaska Native children, Alaska Native language speaking students. That such an onerous policy would unintentionally disadvantage these groups to their peers.
In a press release, a spokesperson for the governor's office said the bill aims to maintain local control and meet the needs of rural and Alaska Native students. At the press conference, Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck said that while the bill doesn't solve every problem in Alaska's education system, it directs funds to important areas like the base student allocation and loan forgiveness for some teachers.
This bill doesn't solve everything, but it really puts money right where a lot of our other problems will be solved.
The bill unanimously passed the Senate and passed the House in a 21-19 vote. Dunleavy is expected to sign the bill into law in the coming weeks. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
A report on Native American boarding schools from the U.S. Interior Department has prompted calls for Congress to do more to investigate the deaths, abuse, and loss of culture that occurred at the schools. Many see the first volume of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative report as just the beginning of the federal government's attempts to document the systemic and forced assimilation of indigenous children at boarding schools. That includes the Friends Committee on National Legislation and its congressional advocate for Native American policy, Portia Skinador-Wheelock. Skinador-Wheelock says some things in the report did not come as huge news, but she says it was surprising to learn how deliberately the boarding school policy was aimed at taking indigenous lands.
And essentially, the goal there was you can't do much about, you know, the adults. So let's focus on the children. Let's westernize them and have them adopt Western agricultural practices, which is very different than traditional tribal practices. So that was one of the main goals there. And, you know, to some extent, that was a very successful part of the policy.
How did this work? I mean, we've heard stories from folks, and there's definitely people here in Alaska, Alaska Native people that lived this, and this isn't going to come as any surprise to them. But for folks that don't know what happened at these schools and how that forced assimilation worked, could you explain that?
Well, so really the foundation is you need to remove the children from their parents, from their tribal communities. And essentially by removing the children from that structure that they would have been raised in and shifting it to being completely isolated, you know, essentially being raised with a lot of fear and shame and violence, contrary to how they would have been raised in their own tribal communities. There were a number of ways in which the government and church leaders were able to do that. One was by force. You physically remove the children by force. Another was using tools of starvation, right? So if you remove large groups of people to reservations, they can no longer sustain themselves in their own ways. So they're completely reliant then on the federal government for food and for commodities. So if you withhold food until they give you your child, you're really forcing their hand. So there were a lot of unconscionable practices like that in order to actually get the children in their care.
Does this report from the Department of Interior at this point, does it get into the things that actually happened at the boarding schools, like not allowing Native children to use their native languages or the physical or emotional abuse that people say occurred?
Yes. So they do get into the curriculum a bit, and that included extensive military drills, a lot of manual labor. Of course, you know, Christian teachings were a part of that as well. And then the abuses, you know, range from the withholding of food, being locked out of the school in cold winters, which you can imagine in Alaska would be really terrifying for a young child. And you have to think too, a lot of these kids were as young as 4 years old. Solitary confinement and being chained up, you know, hit physically and sexually assaulted, all of that, you know, has been documented. But sort of the next step for Interior over this next year is they're going to go around the country and collect more stories and testimony from both survivors and their descendants. And this is why this is so timely. There are still living survivors. So we do need to do as much as possible to not only receive their testimony, but to help them with their healing and sort of start to break down some of that intergenerational trauma that they've been carrying.
And of course, we refer to them as survivors because there are people that didn't make it through this and didn't come home and are presumably buried at some of these sites with unmarked graves. Why were there burial sites at these schools? Why is that such a big part of the story?
Right. Well, death was so common that these schools had both marked and unmarked graves on site. You know, there have also been stories about mass graves where there either wasn't any time or care or concern, whatever the issue, to actually have individual graves. But essentially, those deaths, they're due to a number of things. Neglect is a big one. Abuse as well. Starvation, sickness. So many children did not survive these institutions. And I think that's where that accountability piece comes in. And that's why, even though a number of tribal organizations and tribal nations have been doing some of this work themselves over the years, there really is a need for both the faith community to be involved and the federal government for that accountability.
Does this report get into those long-term generational trauma issues, that cultural trauma that still exists? I mean, does it describe that at all?
It does. There is a section near the end of the report that talks about the consequences and the intergenerational trauma that tribes are continuing to navigate as they reclaim everything that, you know, all of these institutions essentially tried to destroy. And it's really heartbreaking, the state of Indian country today. There are many beautiful things. There's a lot of, you know, younger people especially learning their language and revitalizing traditional agricultural practices. But there are still a lot of struggles. There's a lot of people that are battling addiction as a way to cope with that trauma. And essentially just trying to survive a world that doesn't really fit or understand Indigenous people.
That was Portia Skenador-Wheelock, the Friends Committee on National Legislation's Congressional Advocate for Native American Policy. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Olivia Eberts and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Brian Venois in Dillingham, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.